Hello and welcome to another episode of History Lesson Part 2. I'm Jackson McDonald.
I'm Tyler Shipley.
The movie we will be discussing today, because it is the holiday season, possibly our last episode of 2022, certainly our last episode before Christmas, we will be discussing the 1946 Christmas classic, It's a Wonderful Life, directed by Frank Capra, starring Jimmy Stewart, or I guess James Stewart, as he's always credited in on his IMDb page and such, and Donna Reed, written by Francis Goodrich and Albert Hackett, as well as we will get into later, so about like 7 or 8 other uncredited people. I was the one who suggested this one, and I should also cop to the fact that this is for the first time in History Lesson Part 2 history. That's a weird way of putting it. I did not watch this movie in preparation for the episode.
You know it that well.
I know this movie probably better than most members of my family. I've seen it at least 15 times, likely quite more than that. I cannot remember when I first saw it. It was just a movie that was, my dad liked it, and then my dad showed it to my mom, and then my mom liked it, and then it was just on at Christmas time every year for as long as I can remember. And it has since become basically my favorite movie, but I will say that I'm not one of those people who thinks that your favorite movie and the movie you think is the best movie are the same thing, if that makes sense.
It does make sense. And I'm going to say that this was the first time I ever watched it.
Amazing.
So, yeah, despite, you know, having a few years advantage on you, I had never seen it. Didn't even know very much about it, except for a few sort of like scenes that are ubiquitous in pop culture, which I found like corny and stupid. Like, sure. I knew about the, you know, you want the moon?
Oh, yeah.
Let me lasso the moon, you know, and yeah. I was like, oh, cry. I even, like, honestly, I left it. I didn't even watch it until last night because I was subconsciously, I was like, ah, oh, corny old shit. Okay,
sure. Well,
whatever. Yeah. So it was my first viewing. So I'm coming at it with very fresh eyes.
This movie suffers from the thing that a lot of older, like, classic movies suffer from, which is having something in the movie, an important like line or set piece or whatever, repeated back through popular culture a million times to the point where it kind of loses its oomph.
Which is not the fault of the film. I mean, I know that.
No, it's not. Yeah. Yeah. But it is like definitely a movie that Casablanca is another movie that I think is great. That's a very old, that's a classic that you will never be able to understand the impact of hearing a line like, you know, round up the usual suspects or whatever, because it's just become a cliche. I will say, if we want to get into things that, because I do mostly really like the movie, obviously it's my favorite movie, I do really there are valid criticisms, although I think a lot of the valid criticisms are maybe perhaps a little less of a big deal than some people make them out to me, but the things that I will take on as like valid criticisms are, especially for just people's enjoyment of it, are like, okay, it's very old and has some corny elements that are especially heightened by the fact that like this movie has been ripped off and referenced and parodied a bajillion times since it came out like almost 80 years ago.
True.
And then the other is and we can tease this out over the whole episode, but there is definitely some race and gender happening in it. It is a movie that came out in 1946. Yeah. I think it has gender happening in it more so than race. But that plays a very important role in a couple of different areas.
I was nervous. I will say I was nervous about the way that gender and race was going to happen. I was like, oh boy, some early scenes, I was like, oh shit, here we go.
Yeah,
and
yeah, totally.
In the end, I actually thought for a movie made in 1946 in Hollywood, it was there was less gender going on than I was worried about, and less race. So, I mean, yes, definitely some really uncomfortable moments, but not as many as I expected. So, you know, I'll give it that.
Yeah, I think is a case, I think there's a pretty strong case to be made that it has a relatively progressive outlook on a lot of things for the time it was made. I mean, we're talking about bloody 1946. Yeah. Segregation was still a thing.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you know, interracial marriage was still outlawed in, like, I don't know, probably everywhere for all I know. So you'd never seen the film before. I'm going to say right now for our listeners, I'm going to recommend that if you haven't seen this one, because I'm pretty sure it's very easy, yeah, to find online for free without even having to torrent. Like, it's on YouTube or Dailymotion or something, I'm pretty sure. I recommend, before we get into discussing the plot, discussing everything, go home, watch this one. It's Christmas time. You probably have people in your life that, like, want to watch something to do with Christmas. And the thing about Christmas movies is that most of them suck. Most of them yeah. aren't interesting at all. Most of them just don't really have any kind of point to them or intrigue to them other than just, like, it's Christmas time and it's a movie that reflects, like, Christmas back at you or whatever.
And I will add, like, although I have some criticisms, I enjoyed watching it. So, yeah. You know, like, I endorse this recommendation. Go and
endorse
watch the movie
first. As a movie.
Yeah, I endorse yeah. it as a movie. Yeah. I thought it yeah. was we watched it. It was like a nice movie to watch around Christmas time. You know, we were with it the whole time. We didn't get bored. It's like, it's yep. sophisticated. You know, I mean, sometimes there's a perception that older movies might be like, oh, they're old and simplistic. And like, no, it's, totally. You know, it is like the characters and the emotions and the storytelling is very sophisticated and nuanced and absolutely resonates for a modern audience. So, like, I agree. Watch it first. It's worth it.
So I have all kinds of stuff to say about it and all kinds of opinions on I have my own reading of it. I have opinions on other people's readings of it. But I am, I guess, really curious as someone who had never seen it before versus me being like the foremost expert on it. obviously, I'm kidding, but only a little bit.
Yeah.
What was your perception? Like, what were you expecting going in? What kind of was your perception of the, yeah, what was your perception of the film going in? How did it change over the course of watching it? What were kind of the things that stood out to you? I guess we'll start there, and then I have some other things that I want to ask as well, but I won't lay them all on you all okay. at the same time.
I mean, yeah, like I said, I knew it only as like a few corny scenes that had been repeated too many times. Oh, I'm going to lasso the moon for you. Like, sure, yeah, you know, yeah. But at the same time, vaguely in the back of my head was this connection, this thing about like, oh, it's a socialist movie. Or there's a socialist in it, or the guy's a communist. Like, and I didn't know what, and I didn't investigate. I had never bothered to look up, you know, what was the story. But I just vaguely, you know, maybe someone along the way had said, oh, you should watch It's a Wonderful Life. There's a communist in that or something.
Yeah,
so I had
sure.
this vague
yeah, yeah.
idea that there was this leftist thing to it and expected it to be corny and you know, but I thought, well, you know, okay. In the 1940s, that's the Italian neo-realist films. There's a lot of communist films being made. Maybe it is. It turned out to be the opposite of, in both cases, it was the opposite of what I expected. The movie itself was far better than I expected. The acting, I actually thought the acting was really good. It is corny in a certain way, but it's actually, there was a ton of nuance to it. It was really realistic. It didn't feel like canned dialogue at all. In fact, there's scenes where it almost seems like it's being ad-libbed because, you know, Jimmy Stewart.
I'm gonna interject there because there's a lot of things I love about this movie, but one thing that I think I love about it the most is exactly what you just zeroed in on there, which is that Jimmy Stewart in particular
mm-hmm.
does a thing in this movie that I've never seen someone do in a movie really before. I'm sure there are examples. There aren't a lot of examples earlier than this, certainly, but like some of it is that his character is obviously deaf in one ear, which becomes an important plot point. And so he has this affectation of sometimes asking people to repeat themselves, which is On the one hand, cool because it's very realistic, because in real life, we all mishear or don't hear or miss something that someone said all the time. And of course, in Hollywood, in movie land, everyone hears and understands everything yeah. perfectly. You know, I mean, unless it's like for comedic effect yeah. or like, and this movie actually has kind of some interesting, like, disability is not at the forefront of it, I would say. And it's not necessarily trying to make a comment of on disability, but it has an interesting, like, disability lens to it. And so that's one thing. And one affectation I've, like, stolen in my own personal life from George Bailey in this movie is saying, "How's that?" when I don't, yeah. when I don't hear someone,
yeah,
or when I would need them to repeat themselves. It's so I really like that. But the other thing that he does that is even better than that is he does things like trail off, cut himself off in the middle of a sentence and regroup.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if it's that he didn't remember his lines or that he remembered the substance of his lines, but wanted to, because I know some actors, they don't memorize the lines as they're written. They read the lines and then try to sort of give their interpretation of it or whatever.
It always, because he does that, it always feels, and this is, you know, it's especially striking because it is an older movie. So, you know, you really expect the canned dialogue and, you know, you maybe don't mind, you
sure.
expect yeah. that going in, but he just seemed remarkably real all the time because of those things. The other one too, maybe you were going to say this, but the other one that I noticed at least two or three times, he kind of stammers, like just the slightest kind of stammer, the way most of us do. Like he starts one word, but then decides he's going to say a different thing. So he'll kind of go like, he'll make sort of a, and then go and do a different sound. I guess I can't really recreate it. But he does this thing it makes it so real. And I just found, like, as the movie went on, I found that element of it really interesting and compelling and totally unexpected. Like, this last thing I would have thought, you know, I was watching the movie for.
Especially because he's not portrayed as, like, a weak-willed or nebbishy or, like, stammery or man, you know?
No,
like
exactly.
He's portrayed as, like, a strong guy, like the kind of everyman that you would base a movie around, right?
He's well spoken, he's articulate, and he gives that speech to the board at some point. And the speech to the board is perfect because it is so articulate and well put and forceful, and it carries, I mean, you know, you can't help but almost cheer while you're watching it. And yet in that speech in particular, he's doing the thing you described where he's kind of like trailing off and then restarting. It just, it's exactly like, I mean, if you've ever been in a union meeting, you know, at a crucial moment in a union meeting, maybe, or a community town hall, when some normal person gets to the mic and makes a point that just absolutely moves the room. And it's usually someone who isn't like a perfectly polished speaker, but someone who like has it, the core of it is there, but they're kind of working to get the words out. And that's what he feels like.
Yeah. I'm glad you mentioned that scene because that scene is really, it's the thing that as I get older, you know, people have different things in this movie that make them choke up. I've, of course, having watched it since I was a child, I've also had different things that make me choke up in different moments. And there's one that I want to save a little bit when we get more into the plot rather than just sort of the themes that I think makes almost everyone choke up. I remember I read a review of this movie in like the AV Club, I think, or something, that was basically they had a series where they had these movie writers do a review of a movie that everyone else has seen, but they haven't seen. It was basically the theme of it, right? So it's like, I'm trying to think of a good example for me. And I'm coming up blank right now, but it's like if you meet somebody and they've never seen Star Wars.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're like, "How have you never seen Star Wars? Everyone's seen Star Wars." And they just shrug their shoulders and they're like, "I don't know, I've just never seen it." And so, and then you get that person who's a movie person who writes about movies to write a review of Star Wars
yeah.
based on being a 35-year-old woman who's never seen Star Wars or
that's
whatever,
a cool
right?
idea. Yeah.
And there was a person who did a review in on this, and they kind of had a similar viewpoint as you, being like, it's probably really corny. I don't know if it's going to be very good. I don't expect it to be. I expect it to be pretty cheesy and whatever. And then I can't remember if they were a man or a woman, or if they lieth betwixt. but the person who wrote the article said, like, they're like, yeah, I was expecting it to be schmaltzy or whatever. And then they're like, and then literally by the end of the first scene, I was tearing up, which I thought was very funny.
Yeah.
Because that's a very like it's, there's a lot of pathos in it. And of course they have the kids, and you have the kid with the, just, I don't know what it was about kids in old movies, like kids in like the 40s or whatever, but they have these like impossibly cute like voices, and just being like, you know, like, I'm really worried about my daddy or whatever. Yeah. And you're like, oh geez. You know, so the people choke up sometimes at that or whatever, but the part that makes me choke up is the speech, that you mentioned. And it is, I think for the people who talk about this movie as having a political valence in a positive way, this is kind of the thing that they're talking about. And it isn't a political program necessarily. It isn't even necessarily presented and it certainly isn't presented in like a political way, but as a statement or as an argument, it's certainly extremely relatable and extremely cathartic to watch just some guy who is essentially just some guy scream this at a rich person.
Now, you take this loan here, the Ernie Bishop, you know, the fellow that sits around all day on his brains in his taxi, you know. I happen to know the bank turned down this loan, but he comes here and we're building him a house worth $5,000. Why?
Well, I handled that, Mr. Potter. You have all the papers there, his salary, insurance. I can personally vouch for his character.
Friend of yours?
Yes, sir.
You see, if you shoot pool with some employee here, you can come and borrow money. What does that get us? A discontented, lazy rabble instead of a thrifty working class. And all because a few starry-eyed dreamers like Peter Bailey stir them up and fill their head with a lot of impossible ideas. Now, I say...
Just a minute. Now, hold on, Mr. Potter. Just a minute. Now, you're right when you say my father was no businessman. I know that. Why he ever started this cheap penny-ante building alone, I'll never know. But neither you nor anybody else can say anything against his character, because his whole life was... Why, in the 25 years since he and Uncle Billy started this thing, he never once thought of himself. Isn't that right, Uncle Billy? He didn't save enough money to send Harry to school, let alone me. But he did help a few people get out of your slums, Mr. Potter. And what's wrong with that? Well, here, you're all businessmen here. Don't it make them better citizens? Doesn't it make them better customers? You said that they... What did you say just a minute ago? They had to wait and save their money before they even thought of a decent home? Wait for what? Until their children grow up and leave them? Until they're so old and broke them down that they... You know how long it takes a working man to save $5,000? Just remember this, Mr. Potter, that this rabble you're talking about, they do most of the working and paying and living and dying in this community. Well, is it too much to have them work and pay and live and die in a couple of decent rooms and a bath? Anyway, my father didn't think so. People were human beings to him, but to you, a warped, frustrated old man, they're cattle. Well, in my book, he died a much richer man than you'll ever be.
So if I remember correctly, he just kind of interrupts Potter and goes off on him. And he says, what'd you say just a minute ago? That they had to wait and save their money before they even thought of, to think, or sorry, before they even ought to think of a decent home? Wait for what? Until they're sold and broken down that they... And then he stops.
Mm-hmm.
And for a bit of context there, of course, as I've said, you should just go watch the movie. But to set the scene a little bit, like, George Bailey is this sort of like regular guy, lives in a small, idyllic, like normal Norman Rockwell town of Bedford Falls. And he has the very, you know, kind of standard, like, ambitious young man, wants to travel, wants to see the world, wants to, you know, Not clear what he actually wants to do necessarily. He talks a lot about doing a bunch of different things that would seemingly be impossible to do as one man. And when he kind of first sets off on his journey to try and do that, his father, who owns a local building and loan, dies. George has to put off his travels to kind of settle things at the building and loan. And then when it comes time for him to finally like set it aside and leave, there's a board meeting where Mr. Potter, the evil, rich, my, you know, just
Scrooge,
like,
just think Scrooge.
Think Scrooge, but this movie has the balls to make Scrooge a bad guy for the whole thing.
Yeah.
And understand that he is like terrible and irredeemable.
Yeah.
He's on the board and he wants to dissolve the building and loan. And the board members, are kind of, they're debating what to do with it or whatever. And George gives that speech and it convinces the board members that the building and loan should continue to exist, but only if George takes it over. And that kind of sets in place like a bunch of events that keep George stuck in Bedford Falls, running this building and loan and kind of putting his own ambitions and desires for himself and his life aside to continue to run the institution. And we'll get into more like plot details and stuff later. But
and I will have things to say about the sort of the politics of like, you know, his building and loan company and what it is that they're doing and so on. Like I have those are the points where I struggled. So I, funny enough, to bring it full circle to was my initial reaction? So my initial reaction was that I expected the movie to be corny, but I was like intrigued at the possibility that it would have some really interesting socialist politics. Instead found the movie exceptional as a film. And in my opinion, pretty weak politically. To the extent that there are politics in the film, beyond a general invocation towards generosity of spirit, which is fine.
Yes.
And comradely solidarity with one's community, which is fine, but also that's in every Christmas movie almost.
Yeah.
You know, the sentiment is there and you know what almost every Christmas movie doesn't do is have anyone really act meaningfully on those, you know, those kind of gestures. And I don't think the film realizes in any way like a kind of politics of that. And the politics that it does push fall extremely short for me.
Sure.
And in some ways because I ended up liking the film as much as I did. Like if I'd hated the film and found it boring, I probably wouldn't care that it was like at best a kind of Bernie Sanders, you know, tax the rich a bit more kind of politics. But because I liked the film, in the end I was mad because I genuinely hated Potter. He's a fuck. Mm-hmm. He's an absolute fuck. Yeah. And what he deserves at the end of that film is to be hung from the corner of Red Square. You know, Bedford Falls has had a revolution. Everyone has recognized the injustice, the insane injustice of the system. And, you know, likable everyman, George Bailey, has been elected the first secretary of the People's Commission of New Bedford.
Like,
you know, certainly. Potter is hanged. Yeah. His wealth is redistributed. All, you know, his slums are liberated.
I'm not going to do it yet because I want to. There's other threads I want to get to first, but I'm excited to compare your feelings about this movie to my feelings about, I mean, I know the last episode was actually about a few different movies, but my idea is specifically about Parasite.
Right.
Because I think there's some overlap.
Okay.
In terms of, it should be like this. The working class people should be better people. They should have solidarity.
Uh-huh.
And like, you know, and then in It's a Wonderful Life, it's like, why do the townspeople not simply hang the rich asshole?
Yeah.
I will say, to quickly put a pin in that speech that we mentioned a second ago, I love the way that he just trails off,
yeah,
and you know, kind of doesn't allow himself to, It's like he catches himself.
Yeah, yeah.
People become so old and broken down that they, and then he goes, and then it's like, I shouldn't say that.
Yeah, yeah.
I shouldn't go any further with that.
Yeah, it's brilliant. Like from the standpoint of storytelling and the realism and the power of the moment, that like that makes the speech for me. That was what made it, was the trail off, reconsider. Like I said before, like it reminded me of when people have spoken up in meetings that I've been in, and when I felt sort of moved by a speech, it was invariably someone who's like, they're out there as far as they can. They're at the edge of their rhetorical capacity, you know?
Yes.
Their oratory skills are being pushed to the limit and they're succeeding, but they're faltering from time to time. You know, it's just such a real, it's so well executed.
And I will say from a political standpoint, it certainly does not sound like anything you would really necessarily read in like Lenin. It sounds kind of like a Bernie Sanders.
It does.
Speech, honestly.
Yeah.
But it is emotionally resonant and politically, quote unquote, resonant. You know, you can meld politics and philosophy here a lot when you talk about this movie, but just that, I know for me at various stages in my life, it was very cathartic. It meant a lot to me to turn this movie on every Christmas Eve when I'm often at my most broke and see someone on screen talking about, even if it's on the most simple level, like the people who do the work should have the dignity to be able to live a nice life while they do that work, have things like rooms to raise their children in and a decent bathroom and yada yada yada, right?
Oh yeah, that part, that stuff is all perfectly like commensurate with Lenin. That stuff is all great. The film diagnoses the problem well and articulates the problem. It's just that the solution is so weak,
it has no solutions.
Yeah, yeah.
It actually has no solution, which is a thing that interests me that we will come back to, because that is ultimately, I think, what makes this movie interesting and kind of, it's not what makes the movie interesting, but it's what makes interpretations and debates about the political context of this movie, the political content of this movie, and it's like philosophy interesting, is that, in the end, basically not much changes. In fact, nothing changes really. Basically, the thing that changes at the end of the movie is that Potter is slightly more rich.
Yeah, that's right.
And we'll get to that a little bit later. But one thing I do just want to say about the character of Henry F. Potter is it is a credit to the filmmakers and the writers that character's name is Henry F. Potter and not like Shlomo Hebrewberg.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Like Potter is a wasp, and I respect that a lot, that they, because they could have very easily, in contrast, I think Ebenezer Scrooge is at least Jewish coded.
Yeah.
And I mean, certainly Charles Dickens, we know he had some foibles when it came to talking about Semitic peoples. But
I thought about them for not doing
anti-Semitism in this.
Yeah. No, I thought about it too. It was one of the first thoughts I had, was like, okay, interesting. Potter the character is 100% still written as the scheming Jewish banker of those anti-Semitic conspiracy theories.
I would still
probably say, especially knowing what I know about Frank Capra, the director, who had, pictures of Mussolini and Franco on his desk. I don't fully trust that there isn't still a certain narrative running through the film that resonates with that old anti-Semitic thing. Because it is still ultimately, it's your banker is the bad guy, specifically your money guy, right? And that was always associated with, the sort of anti-Semitic conspiracy theories about Jewish bankers and money lenders. And your good guy is a waspy, Main Street guy. He's a
sure,
yeah. The good capitalist. But I agree with you. Like, it is noteworthy and significant that he is that the Jewish banker character is not actually played out as Jewish and is in fact, yeah, this waspy guy. I have to think that it being a film that comes out in 1946 is probably pretty significant in terms of that.
Plays a role. Yeah.
I mean, you know, we're talking about what, and here I can do a little history lesson part two moment. You know, what many people don't know about World War II is that, well, anti-Semitism in Nazi Germany is well documented. Anti-Semitism in the West is often ignored. In fact, the West, in retrofitting that history, has often proclaimed itself the liberators of the Jews. And in fact, the West was so deeply anti-Semitic that they argued, and I'm talking here specifically of Canada, the US, and Britain, they argued with one another over who would be forced to accept Jewish refugees, because they were all turning away Jewish refugees during the Holocaust. During the height of the Holocaust, as late as 1943, the three powers meet to discuss what are we going to do about people fleeing from the Holocaust. And they're all so desperate to not take on further Jewish refugees that they refuse to host the meeting. London, Ottawa, and Washington all refused to be the host of the meeting. They had to go to Bermuda to find neutral ground on which to have the meeting so that no one would feel unduly coerced to accept Jewish refugees. The Canadian foreign minister famously said, the number of Jews we will accept is none. What he said was, none is too many. So the West was deeply, deeply anti-Semitic all the way through. You could argue, and there's a strong case that the creation of Israel and support for the creation of the settler state of Israel was in large part a way of deflecting Jewish migration out of Europe somewhere else. It was a way of making sure that all of the people fleeing from Europe, understandably, would go someplace else. So that's your context in terms of that backstory.
And I just to interject there too, I do, as someone who is not necessarily as well versed in history, but like, I do think the Second World War and the fact that this is a like post-war isn't a descriptive enough term to describe how this movie takes place. Christmas Eve, 1945. The war has just ended in this movie.
And that's right.
I think it plays a really, and it came out even in 1946. Like, it plays a huge role.
Yeah.
The fact that this is the absolute beginning of the post-war period. And so I'm actually really glad that this show has like a historical element to it, because that's something that I know exists, but that I can't speak to. Mm-hmm. So I'm excited for you to finish your thought, but also to kind of tease that out a little bit more, the post-war context.
Well, yeah, exactly. Right. Because that's the other big piece, and we'll do that in a minute, but yeah. The post-war reconstruction of capitalism is what this film is. Arguably, that's what the film is propagandizing, is the post-war version of capitalism. And I'll say that as to a certain extent, I guess, you know, a compliment, but mostly I'll say it as a criticism. But yeah, just to kind of finish the thought through, given that the film comes out in 1946, is directed by a guy who was sympathetic to fascism, and is coming out in the context of a society that remains pretty deeply anti-Semitic, I think there is an interesting thing going on where the arc of the story still fits and would be, look, it would be, if you did it, if the Nazis had produced a German version of the same sort of thing, it would have been, in many ways, it would have fit with fascist Nazi Germany ideology. Sure. Bad Jewish bankers, the bad money lending classes, you know, the aristocrats, and then the good German Volk of the community, you know, we're going to stand up for ourselves. I mean, fascism built narratives of that kind of version of the good capitalism. And
you could tweak this movie. Yes. You could make a few minor tweaks of this movie and make it either super duper right wing
mm-hmm.
or super duper left wing.
Exactly. Which is really interesting.
It is. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And I give it credit for the fact that they didn't like go as far as they could have, and that they in fact stepped back from some of them. So I think you're right. Having the banker be called Potter you know, and be very obvious. I mean, he looks like Churchill, actually, the guy.
Yeah, right? He does. It's true. Yeah.
So I appreciate that. I think that's like, you know, I'll give it that much credit, in its, given its context. And then, you know, later on, I'm going to sort of criticize it for its context too, but I'll give it credit there.
I think there's one other important historical element to, not necessarily the movie itself, but just the context it was made in, which is, because it's specifically 1946, we are just at the very end of a period in American history where the mainstream of American society, American politics, American culture has a relationship to communism that is something other than complete, vehement, singular hate, like Eye of Sauron fixed upon this one particular thing as the center of that all violence and struggle must be centered around. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
There's a great book I read around this time last year, actually, called The Folk Singers in the Bureau by Aaron J. Leonard. Leonard is a very communist, like sympathetic historian. He's written a lot about like various like American Maoist groups and splintering and sectarianism, splitting those organizations apart and stuff. And so he wrote this book about the FBI infiltration into the folk music movement, basically from kind of around the 20s to the 60s. And there is a chapter in the book called Uneasy Allies, which details like, so up until 1941 or whatever it is, like the FBI is extremely hostile towards the Communist Party, extremely hostile towards these folk singers, is following them around like crazy, harassing them, meticulously documenting everyone they like go to lunch with and shit and yada, yada, yada. And then all of a sudden the Soviet Union becomes their allies, you know, United States allies for a couple years. And everyone just kind of backs off for a minute. And on the other side of things, the folk singers and the Communist Party, they kind of changed their tune about the war and about America too. And everyone just kind of like, it's not an acceptance. It's just detente. It's just like a brief ceasefire. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And, one of the things that I found really interesting that Leonard talks about is that there is, for a brief, kind of period before, communism in America becomes a little bit more sophisticated, particularly during the Second World War, but also to some extent before and after, there is a string, or a stream of communist thought in America that seeks to kind of retcon communism as the ultimately American thing, which is very funny.
Yeah.
To me, and it's obviously very like naive, but the idea behind it is essentially that, like, okay, well, our Constitution says all men are created equal, and our whole thing is freedom of movement and of thought, and the freedom particularly from authoritarianism and repression and oppression. And so the obvious conclusion to all of those ideas is communism, which is interesting. It's yeah. certainly not very sophisticated, but it's kind of cute, I guess I'll say, in a way. It's endearing in how much some of these early communists or American communists, I shouldn't say early really, but like pre and just post-war communists kind of think that they can redirect classic American patriotism into a more socialist politics. And that is very relevant, I think, to this movie, particularly when we start to talk about some of the people that were involved in its production behind the scenes. But I wanted to ask you if you are like familiar with that phenomenon at all, or have anything to really say about it. Like,
yeah, I mean, the thing that's interesting about it, the thing that's most interesting about it, and unfortunately, like, it's coming back in a weird way. now.
Yeah, yeah.
It's, and I think an even less forgivable way. There is this new patriotic socialism phenomena that is coming around. And it started coming out of the left. Sort of splinters of the left would start taking up this patriotic thing. And I think the idea was like, oh, this will help us appeal because people like patriotism and they like the country, whether it's America or Canada. You know, they like our country. Sure. And this will appeal to them. We'll show them that socialism is in keeping with the principles that our countries are founded upon. It's now also being taken up by the right, who correctly consents that this is idiotic from the perspective of the left, and a goldmine for the right, where the right can recruit people, because ultimately patriotic socialism is going to become right wing.
It's basically a bunch of Americans going like, okay, well, there's a lot of things about socialism we don't like, but there are a few things that maybe make some decent points, like Tucker Carlson is really big on this, like totally unfettered woke capitalism destroys the family and shatters our community institutions. And now, and this is the thing, is that, like, you know, a lot of conservatives will say things about, you know, our communities are being shattered, and like, it's too hard to raise a family, and we're destroying the family. And those things are not untrue. It's just that capitalism is generally the thing that's destroying those things.
Exactly. And that the solution
for someone like Tucker Carlson, who's actually reasonably smart, I think he is able to find a way to criticize capitalism in a very, very, very superficial way.
Exactly.
As essentially being like, well, the problem with capitalism is that it has these unintended consequences.
Exactly.
Such as its effect on the family or whatever. And basically what people, I would say Carlson is at the forefront of it, but there's others too. They're basically doing this thing where they say, well, socialism is bad, but not all of the ideas about it are necessarily bad. Like, we are not leftists. We are hard right conservatives, but we are conservatives in the classic sense of being about God and family, and not, say, we are not liberals. We are not we are not people who believe in pure free market fundamentalism or you know, libertarianism or whatever. And basically the punchline of it is they come around on like, okay, well, not everything about socialism is bad, but internationalism is certainly bad. What if we had this sort of like nationalist socialism?
Exactly.
You know, has that been tried before?
Exactly. Yeah.
Like a socialism that was very national. I think there's maybe some potential there.
Exactly. I was just gonna say that's exactly it, right? I mean, that is the bread and butter of fascism, is to take a very, very superficial criticism of capitalism, boil the criticism down to, and at that time, really, frankly, boil the criticism down to Jewish bankers, you know, make
sure,
it as,
yes,
you know, or some version of that, and frame fascism as a fight for the working class, against the, you know, the woke mob, you know, and so, you know, the thread right from Nazi Germany until the current iterations of fascism is precisely to try to frame it as a people's movement, a movement that represents the real people against the elite, instead of framing the working class against the, you know, capitalist class, instead of being clear about what are the material divisions here, you know, who is exploiting whom and in what ways. They obscure that by turning it into this kind of elite versus the people, which then means you can frame the elite in a certain way, and you can frame the people in a certain way. The people suddenly become, you know, the white people. You know, Tucker Carlson is going to, you know, the way he would cover a Black Lives Matter demonstration would be to suggest somehow that Black Lives Matter is the elite, that there's this new elite, you know, it's Obama and the other, you know, college students, black college students who want to turn us all into slaves of the, you know, this liberal mindset, right? So it's this perversion of class politics. And now here's where I'm going to really piss you off. I think that the film is doing a version of that politics. Now, I don't know if it is doing it consciously, and I certainly don't think, there's no part of me that thinks Even despite it being directed by a fascist, I don't think the film is fascist or intends itself to be fascist. But I think that the film is still portraying ultimately a politics of there are the bad crony capitalists or Jewish bankers, you know, whatever that group, the woke mob. Yeah. I mean, that the woke mob thing doesn't fit as well in this case. So scratch that. But you know, the Jewish bankers.
Okay. We could be a bit facetious here. I'm all right with that.
But then the good guys are, you know, your good old fashioned American business people, family men, gentlemen. Jimmy Stewart is a gentleman, right? He cares about his community. And I think, you know, it's like we said a few minutes ago, this film, it wouldn't be that far out of place in Nazi propaganda with a few key changes, the basic principles of community, and especially the scene where at the end, when Jimmy Stewart discovers what would life have looked like and what would the town look like without his influence, and it turns into a den of vice, right? There's burlesque dancers and nightclubs and jazz music and all the ills and vices of,
Certainly, I would say one of the, it's one of the things that hasn't aged well, and one of the most like race and gender, the film doing race and gender in a way that is not so great for a modern audience, like the most egregious example of it. I'll let you continue in a moment. One thing that I will say is Mussolini's brand of fascism, specifically conceived as society as a body. Like a human body almost, where, you know, for the body to work, for the body to be healthy, all the different parts of the body have to be healthy and have to be working properly. And there's a deep appeal for people in that idea. Me imagining an ignorant version of myself that doesn't know any better from 10 years ago or whatever, the idea that, you know, it's at least telling you like, you're important or you matter in some way, even if it is ultimately kind of saying like, yes, there's the military and the military is above the workers and the industrial workers are above this type of workers. And, you know, and there's predatory people who work in finance and and yada, 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 or whatever. And
we just have to. This is, I mean, sorry to interrupt you, but it's a good point you're making. This is precisely the appeal of fascism. Yeah. And it's what some people on the left, and actually it's what liberals in particular do not understand. And that's part of the reason liberals don't understand fascism and can't do anything about it is because they don't understand its appeal. Its appeal is order. It will give you order in a world that seems chaotic. And which can be applied, people can feel that in a million different ways. The most obvious is that capitalism just generally creates chaos and anxiety. You don't know how you're going to pay your rent. You don't know if your job is secure. You know, so many aspects of your life are out of your control. But then, you know, fascists will also weave into that. Well, we don't even know what gender is anymore. Oh my God. Men can be women. Women can be men. People can be nothing. You know, why can't a man just be a man and a woman a woman? It's a way of speaking to the part of us that is afraid of chaos and afraid of change. It's why Jordan fucking Peterson, literally, his shit is all about, I'm afraid of a chaos dragon and I'm going to give you 12 rules to bring order to your life. I mean, these are the core values of fascism. And, you know, if we're honest about them, they have some appeal. There's a reason people are drawn to them because, I mean, I do feel like my life is insecure. If my landlord doesn't like me, he can find an excuse to throw me out of the home that I have built for myself. And that could happen any moment. I can't control it. If fascism offers me, you know, order, offers me a way and a unchanging community where people will be the same and, you know, everyone will have their role and they will do it and it will be good and we will all be together. That all can sound quite appealing if you don't interrogate the specifics of it. You know, who gets what role? How are these roles built into hierarchies? And how are certain people going to be inevitably oppressed in those roles? And of course, fascism doesn't tell you that it's going to be like that. They say the trains are going to run on time. They just don't tell you that the trains are going to run on time because all the train drivers are going to be shot if they don't get back to work and stop going on strike.
Absolutely. Yes. And so through that lens, I do think your viewpoint has a certain merit to it because it could, essay with big ellipses around it be read as being kind of an endorsement of that body-like idea of what community and society should be. Mm-hmm. Everyone has their role, rigidly, maybe not enforced, but boxed in. And as long as they do their role that they're naturally predisposed to or whatever,
mm-hmm.
like society works or whatever. And I disagree with that reading, but I understand why you would have it. And mm-hmm. I will lay out sort of what I think as we move closer towards the end. But now I think is a good time to just sort of briefly explain how this move. For those of you that didn't watch it because you're assholes or whatever, or just don't remember because you haven't seen it in a long time, the way this works out is basically, you know, we have the scene set. George Bailey is running the building alone, and he continues to be beset by negative circumstances that or events that keep him where he is. One very notable one that I want to return to later is the Great Depression, the stock market crash in 1929. He and his wife are about to go on honeymoon. There's a run on the bank. Everyone shows up at the building and loan looking for their money now. And the way that they end up saving the building and loan, and by extension, saving all of these townspeople from going and getting a 50% haircut,
yep,
on all of their savings by giving their money over to Potter, who takes over the bank. It is notable, by the way, too, I think, that Potter is not a banker. He takes over the bank.
True.
Because he's super rich,
yeah,
or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And he takes advantage of the depression, which once again, just there are small distinctions that I think are important, mm-hmm, in certain, mm-hmm, places. And so what ends up happening is George and his wife, Mary, they give away their entire honeymoon fund to keep all of the members of the building and loan afloat. Because the way the building and loan works, and I want to talk a little bit about savings and loan, buildings and loan of the time, et cetera, a little bit later, because how they work and what they are is important, I think, to define a little bit better. The agreement that people have is if they want to take money out, you know, you write up a thing and you say, you know, I want this much money, or I want to close the account or whatever, and you get your money in 30 days, right? And yeah, so for a lot of these people, they can't wait 30 days, understandably. The fucking stock market just crashed. It's like the biggest economic devastation ever of all time.
It was a great scene. It's done really well, by the
it's
way.
Really, it's one of the best scenes in the
it's
movie.
It's really well
so
done.
They,
yeah.
The, and this is where, like, I actually don't think that George Bailey is some, like, hero. I think that's an incorrect reading of the movie from my personal point of view anyways. But this is really one of the scenes where you're really touched by him as a guy,
mm-hmm,
and his wife, actually. And it's very cool, yeah, I will say, that it's actually Mary's idea to do this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
she pulls the stack of money out,
yeah,
and George looks at her and he goes, okay, how much do you need?
Yeah.
And he's immediately thinking, like, okay, I have this much money. If I give it all away, maybe I can keep this thing,
yeah,
afloat or whatever. And it's he's specifically giving it to a way to all the members or whatever. And, mm-hmm, and so that's one thing that happens. Of course, the war comes, they have more children. And eventually what kind of sets the stage for the part of the movie that everyone remembers, even though hilariously Christmas does not come in, yeah, to the plot of this movie until the, yeah, 99 minute mark.
Yeah, that's true.
The vast majority of it is told in flashback.
Speaking of which, before you get to that, uh-huh, conclusion,
yes,
like, I do think another really important point to make in there is that what the buildings and loan, what George's company is doing is basically offering an alternative to the bank, an alternative, yes, to Potter, where, mm-hmm, if you go to Potter, you know, you're going to get fleeced. You're going to get ripped, yeah, off. The terms are going to be terrible. Like, you know, and that speech he gives about, you know, shouldn't people have a roof over their head? So that's, yeah, what the, totally, buildings and loan do, is they operate basically at a loss, loaning money to people that they know they probably aren't going to get back, at least not anytime soon. But it's an investment in them and the community in general, so that they can have houses, so they can build houses and live dignified lives, all of which, you know, that all sounds good to me.
Very, very importantly, to the kinds of people who would never be able to do it otherwise.
Yes. Yeah.
One thing that, and this is interesting because it's certainly Capra's influence that yeah, is that results in this.
Yeah.
Like the two most, I think, most obvious illustrations of this are Ernie the cab driver,
yeah,
who is the guy that they're arguing about in the meeting, basically, that brings this whole thing up.
Yeah.
And then the perhaps even more important is Giuseppe Martini, who owns the bar in the community. He's Italian. He's an Italian immigrant with an Italian accent.
A
very fake Italian accent. And it's 1945 by the end of the movie. Italians are not really white yet.
No.
Not in the sense that we think of people being white anyways. Yeah. Like Italians face a lot of discrimination. They face a lot of poverty. And so it's funny to watch. It's hilarious to watch now in retrospect. But like the stuff that happens with the martinis is actually an attempt to show cross ethnic solidarity.
Yeah.
I think anyways.
Yeah. It is
definitely intended to frame Potter as xenophobic and the Baileys as not.
Yeah. Which, you know, it's a good, I think it certainly crystallizes both the strengths and limitations in some ways of the film, right?
Sure.
Because
yep.
the film is strong enough and good enough to say, here's a guy who will stick up for people in his community who, you know, are disadvantaged, like the Italians, this immigrant community. And yet, you know, there aren't black people getting homes. The only black character in the film is the servant in George Bailey's house.
Is the maid, yeah.
So,
which is unfortunate, but once again, just to place it in its context, could be so much worse.
Yeah, oh sure, yeah.
There is at least a sense of, like, she is part of the community, even part of the, you know, I hesitate to say part of the family because that can be very, you can go down a very bad road very quickly. But the one black character in the movie is not a great portrayal, certainly, but it's not it's not nearly as bad as it could be.
Yeah.
She's portrayed positively in the sense that, like, she's supposed to be a good person
who everyone
who has a relationship with her perceives to be a good person, treats as a good person. Like,
she's demeaned. I mean, there's ways in which she's demeaned and played for jokes at times, you know, but
absolutely.
Let me put it this way. The film is significantly less racist than 1999's The Boondock Saints.
Great. Yeah. Right? Perfect. Yes. Yeah. A movie made like over 50 years later.
Yeah.
So eventually what ends up happening is George's uncle Billy, who is kind of grandfathered in as another major figure in the Building and Loan because he is the brother of Peter Bailey, who founded it. He has an envelope of $8,000 that he needs to deposit in the bank. That's like it's like the business's. I don't even know what it is necessarily what the sum of money is actually for. But it's a large sum of money that needs to be deposited in the bank. And of course, because Potter owns the bank, Billy runs into Potter. And I would say now, with the benefit of hindsight, and also as someone who knows this subject matter very deeply, very intimately, I would say Uncle Billy is coded as having ADHD. He has no memory whatsoever, loses things all the time, constantly gets distracted, and he ends up accidentally leaving the envelope of money in like Potter's book that he has open. And of course, Potter, being who he is, sees this sum of money and just takes it.
Even worse, actually, he takes the money and then presses the issue so that Bailey's
the bank examiner loan.
Yeah, the bank examiner is going to look and the money's going to be missing and there's going to be questions of where did the money go and did George steal it? And presumably, you know, George will go to jail and the building and loan will be shut down. So Potter actually presses his advantage.
You know what this means? Bankruptcy. Scandal.
Yeah.
God, I love the way Jimmy Stewart talks. Exactly. And then that's when we reach the part of the movie that everyone kind of knows, that everyone's kind of familiar with. George is going to commit suicide at the last moment, his guardian angel is sent down. And before people start rolling their eyes and thinking that this is a religious movie, they send him the most fail angel in the world.
Like, actually, the scenes are really good and funny.
And he is, and the guy who plays Clarence is great, by the way.
Yeah, oh, totally. And Jimmy Stewart's responses to the angel are really funny. Like, he's totally, he's completely incredulous about it for almost the entire time that the angel is in the movie. He finds it as stupid as you would as the audience, which is brilliant. It makes it actually somehow work, which I didn't expect.
So eventually, he and Clarence having this conversation about the value of life and why he shouldn't kill himself or whatever, he eventually says, like, you know what? I suppose you're right. I suppose it would have been better if I had just never been born. And, you know, Clarence, having the omniscient power of the Lord inside of him, is able to make that a reality and show him what the world would be like if he was never born. And some of the things that are portrayed are a little silly, a little goofy, like, for example, the thing that you alluded to earlier, which is like, oh no, there's burlesque clubs now, and the bar plays jazz instead of, like, whatever. Jazz. And of course, all of that stuff is very silly. But then there's other stuff that's very important. There's no Bailey Park. There's no decent houses in the community anymore. Yeah. There's more poverty. There's more police. I don't know if you picked up on that, but, like, there's more police. There's more crime. And some of this is more, you could take a right-wing view of it as well.
Exactly.
But there's also other things that point sort of more in the opposite direction. The one I think that connects with me the most, one of the things that I find so interesting is that two of the most important things that George is shown to have done in his life were things he did when he was a young child, like 12, right? The first and the most famous is that when his brother was 9 years old, they were sledding in the wintertime. He crashed through the ice in a lake and George saved him from drowning. And that's how he loses hearing in 1 year. And, he, of course, the really famous scene at the end of the movie is they're in what should be Bailey Park, but is now a cemetery. And he finds his brother's headstone and sees that he had died at 9 years old because George wasn't there to save him. And the part that that makes this, like, all the more important is that while George, because of his ear, was not admitted to the army during World War II, his brother was and became a massive war hero. Because he shot down a kamikaze as it was headed for a big military transport with, you know, it's never stated how many people were on there, but it's a lot. He gets a medal and shit. Right. And I like the characterization of George's brother, who's not in it that much, but he's not a totally lovable character. Like, he's a bit of a shithead. It's kind of subtle. But he has this, like, jockey vibe. He's the one who, not by the standards of the time, but certainly by today's standards, like sexual harassment of the maid. But he's, like, the big jock war hero or whatever, because he saved all these guys on this military transport. And the big gut punch of the movie is when you see his headstone in a reversal of the Scrooge headstone from a Christmas Carol.
Yeah, where it's his own.
Yeah, where it's and it's his brother's, and he gets in a shouting match with Clarence.
Your brother, Harry Bailey, broke through the ice and was drowned at the age of 9.
That's a lie. Harry Bailey went to war. He got the Congressional Medal of Honor. He saved the lives of every man on that transport.
Every man on that transport died. Harry wasn't there to save them because you weren't there to save Harry. You see, George, you really had a wonderful life. Don't you see what a mistake it would be to throw it away?
It's a great use of the trope of when you say the title of the movie in the movie. One of the best instances, I think, of him saying, and it really, like, punches you. You're like, holy shit, that's not how I was expecting that to come up.
Mm-hmm.
I know, certainly for me, like, even as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's, like, that's the one that's sort of the most important that people remember the most. But the one that connects with me the most, actually, is that there's a scene early on in the movie, kind of right after he saves his brother, where he works for Mr. Gower, who is the what they call the druggist.
Yeah, the pharmacist.
He's a pharmacist who also runs a, like, just the most hilarious conception of a business now. Simultaneously a place where people get their medication, but also, like, there's a soda fountain and everyone's eating ice cream and all the kids hang out there or whatever. And Mr. Gower's son, early on in the movie dies. It's off screen, but you see a telegram that he receives that his son died of the Spanish flu. And, you know, we don't know that much about Mr. Gower necessarily, but he, when we see him in this scene, he is drunk out of his mind and kind of a blubbering mess over the death of his son. And he tries to send Harry out with some drugs for a family for a young child, I think. And sorry, did I say Harry? I obviously
yeah,
meant
it was
George.
It was George. It was
George,
our
obviously. Sorry. And George just kind of doesn't do it. And he doesn't really say why he doesn't do it.
It's very unclear actually what is happening in that scene. And I'll say that we didn't fully understand
it,
what
it's
was
something
going
that
on.
Becomes more clear the more times you watch it.
I'm sure. Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, it certainly becomes clear at the end. Like we figure out at the end when as I was watching it the first time, I thought he was trying to kill himself. And
yeah,
I thought
okay.
that George had sort of maybe saved him from killing himself.
Sure. That does make sense. Like that I yeah. can see how you would get that impression. But what really happens is basically George gets these drugs from Mr. Gower, and I believe there's a scene where like he is shown like either looking at them, or I know Gower tastes them, but I feel like he maybe tastes them as well, and he doesn't take the drugs to where they're supposed to go. He doesn't deliver them. It hit me very hard because it's in that very that thing that happens to kids that always breaks your heart, where it's like you see a kid in a situation that is just beyond his grasp to understand or deal with really properly. And so his way of dealing with it is just to kind of be like, well, I don't want to upset my boss. I don't want to upset this adult, but I also can't do this thing that they asked me to do because they don't understand that it's going to hurt someone.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I guess I'll just not do it and see what happens.
Yeah.
Now, of course, Gower gets a phone call. The drugs are never received, and he flips out, and he smacks George upside the head quite a few times to the point where his bad ear starts bleeding. And George tells him, young little 12-year-old George tells him, like, you put something bad in those drugs. Like, I know it's not your fault. I read the telegram, but you can't give them out. And then he opens up the capsule and he gets him to taste it. And Gower tastes it and realizes, oh, holy shit. And then they kind of hug. Gower from that moment on just kind of appears as like a sort of fatherly, like he buys George a suitcase when George wants to go on his first big vacation or whatever. They return to Gower's a few times as a, like, it's like a hotbed of, you know, it's where the kids go to drink at the soda fountain and have fun and hang out or whatever. It becomes this little community hub. And of course, in Pottersville, in the version of Bedford Falls where he had never been, where George had never been born, Gower spent years in jail and is a homeless alcoholic.
Yeah.
Or I should say unhoused alcoholic. Homeless is a bad word, but, it's not a good descriptive term, I should say. And, I think the reason why that one hit me the most, like, if we want to talk about this movie having kind of a more progressive a viewpoint than you, I think, could reasonably expect for a movie of that time, this movie has a lot of sympathy for people who are not perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Like, no one in this movie, if we want to compare it to Parasite for a moment, a lot of people in this movie are pretty shitty in a lot of different ways. You know, Gower smacks this kid upside the head, which of course probably seems more shocking now than it did at the time, but it's certainly meant to, you're certainly meant to be like, well, holy shit, like, yeah, this is a really bad thing to do. Like, he's got clearly a drinking problem. I also really, if we want to talk about the gender aspect of the movie, there's some stuff with Mary that's not, that kind of, especially towards the end, is kind of goofy. But I like its I generally like its portrayal of Violet Beck, the other main female character in the movie, who is kind of a sort of like a Mae West light sort of type woman. She is, I don't want to say portrayed as like a loose woman, because,
well, I think she is, though. I was going to say, like, okay, she is actually portrayed as like kind of a, you know, of a floozy.
Sure.
And yet it's a sympathetic portrayal.
Completely.
At the same time.
It's totally sympathetic. It doesn't really judge her.
No.
Like, if anything, I would say the movie almost subtly hints at the idea that she's maybe had kind of a tough life. And there's been a lot of speculation as to what the money he gives her near the end of the movie is for.
An abortion, perhaps, or whatever, yeah.
Well, that was the thing that I thought was really interesting, is that's what my, when I watched it with my wife, that's what she said, is she said, is he giving her money for an abortion?
Yeah.
Which, of course, they could never be explicit
about.
Yeah.
And what's really cool about the way that I think they do her is that in Pottersville, when you see the version of the world without good George Bailey, who was always kind of there helping Violet out along the way, you know, she's really fallen through the cracks. We see her very briefly being escorted out of like a club where she's been involved in some kind of altercation. Like, it's obvious that her life has kind of spun out. And, you know, I think that, and in my most generous reading of the film, it's like, you know, it's about sort of saying, look, if there isn't a basic sort of community and safety net for people, flawed people, like, their flaws will undo them, you know? Whereas if flawed people are in a community that has care and where people take responsibility for one another, you know, those flaws will not become their undoing. They will just be part of the mosaic of, you know, the community. And I appreciate that aspect of it. I think that's a fair point, and one that any real leftist would agree
certainly
with.
Certainly my
take
favorite
up.
Thing about the
movie. Yeah. Like, anyone who's serious about left politics, like, that is in many ways at the core of what we believe. Of course, every person is flawed. Every person is different. They've got their own shit. We're always going to. There is no utopian world where we won't all have our own shit and our own interpersonal things and problems and so on. But that we believe that we should live in a society that helps us through those things, and that is structured into supporting us through our various problems so that they don't undo us, and so that they don't lead to just sort of endless misery and pain, but that they can be managed and managed as part of a community. That's what we believe as people of the left. So that kernel works for me.
Yes. I think if this movie actually has like a single sentence summation of what the message of the movie actually is, it's just as simple as "there but for the grace of God go I." Like, the most obvious point that it makes and that you can take away from it is the sense that, like, any person could be a bad day away from having their life destroyed for no real reason. And I want to return to that in a moment, but just to finish off the plot, George, you know, he goes through the whole, you know, run of seeing how much worse off a lot of people would be. His uncle Billy's in an asylum. His mother runs like a boarding house, and she's very stern and severe. I think it's sort of implied that she had a very tough time after her husband died. Yeah. And most hilariously, his wife must suffer the indignity of becoming a librarian and wearing glasses, which is funny because, you know, it's one of those things that lands with more of a thud now than was ever intended at the time, because it seems now to be making the case that, like, it's like, oh, that, you know, I look at how awful this woman has it that she's not married and she has to be a librarian. But that's not, like, the point of that scene is actually supposed to be the trauma, because George and Mary have been at the heart of the movie and their relationship has been at the heart of the movie. And there's never any doubt that they have a loving family and have a very healthy, loving family, I would say, in a lot of ways, even by today's standards. The point of the scene is supposed to be the trauma of George not being recognized by his wife.
Yeah, I know.
But it doesn't land super well, because it kind of seems to be implying that, like, it would be it's really bad for women to have to work, which I don't think.
I think you're right that the point of the scene is to emphasize, like, oh, George and Mary aren't a thing. Isn't that jarring? I also think, like, I am not going to put it past a guy who had a picture of Franco and Mussolini on his desk.
Oh, no.
To say
certainly.
Women's job is to pump out 4 babies and be a good mother, not to be a spinster working at a library. Like, I you know, I'm not going to forgive
that one. There's an element
of
that for sure, right?
Yeah.
then there is an element of that kind of thinking certainly seeping in places where it's not that I'm going to say like that reading is wrong. It's just that there's more to it than just that.
Of course. Yeah.
And in this case, too, I will add that, and I kind of wanted to mention this, so this is as good a place as any, I guess, to mention, is that there is this sort of trend in left-wing thinking now, particularly, that kind of equates being left-wing or being a leftist with sort of just being a libertine. And what I mean by that is that, like, because so many of our ideas about sex and drugs and family are so deeply patriarchal, are so deeply misogynistic, so deeply influenced by capitalism, that basically, like, if you're a monogamous person who doesn't drink or have sex, there must be something, or have sex outside of marriage or whatever, doesn't do drugs, like that kind of stuff, that you must be like a square right wing, right? And one thing that I will say is that I'm being a little bit probably more generous than I should be with this, but Mary in her life with George is very, very happy. She's very, very fulfilled. And I think you can make the case that for her, this is certainly like not the life that she wanted, and not the life that she, not a life that she's happy in, and that she's much happier in her life being a housewife. And I, is one of those things where it's like, I never want to make the case. A thing that I say a lot is that people have always looked down on homemakers and women who take care, stay home and take care of the kids and do housework and don't go out and have a traditional job or whatever. And there's a lot of different ways to look at that. Some of which are very fair and others not so much. On the one side, there's no denying that women entering the workforce was like an emancipatory moment for women all over the world, but particularly in North America. You don't have to be stuck in a shitty marriage anymore. You don't have to have children to have a life. And all of that is good. But at the same time, culturally, it kind of replaces the idea of the most important thing in your life is to have a family and to have children with the most important thing of your life is to have a job, is to participate in capitalism. Mm-hmm. And something that I say very often is that the death of single income families has arguably been a net negative on people, on society, but where it gets muddled and where people make the mistake is to assume that the man should be the one or is the one with the single income. Problem is not, it's not women staying home to raise children. It's that men should also be allowed to do that. You know what I mean? Like, the single income family is a good thing.
Yeah.
It's just that, like, if, you know, if you take any old family and the woman wants to be the one who goes out and works and the man wants to be the one who stays home and cleans and cooks and does all the chores and takes care of the kids, great. It's a totally absurd, retrograde, reactionary idea to say that, like, a woman is better suited to do that than a man, or vice versa.
Obviously. Yeah, yeah.
And so that is where it's like, for in this particular case, like, I'm not giving it a pass, and I'm not saying it's not a very regressive view of a woman's role in society. It's just that I also think that it is at least, from a storytelling standpoint, a valid change for that character to go
through. For sure. I'm actually not going to push. I'm not going to push back on this point at all. I think I agree with you. And you know, I mean, look, you know, in terms of the general stuff about exploitation in homes, I mean, women entering into the workforce, I should say women re-entering the workforce Western capitalism, because initially working class women all worked. And that's why, you know, in Dickens' era, when, you know, if we're talking about A Christmas Carol, you know, why are there so many fucking orphans? Well, it's because both men and women are being worked to death in factories and mines.
Yeah.
And at a certain point, there is this crisis in Victorian England of orphans and what to do with, like, street urchins and not reproducing the working class, because these people, these kids grow up to be, like, not capable of holding a job and doing it. And so there's this panic, and women are put back into the role of staying home and doing social reproduction. When that gets reversed and women start entering the workforce again, it's not like they stopped doing the work around the home. It's just meant that women were double exploited. They're now going out and being exploited by a capitalist for 8 hours and their husband for the next eight. So, I don't think that that's, I mean, it's funny, and I'm here to make fun of it, and I'm here to make fun of the idea Mary's a spinster. Yeah, and it is. I don't absolve Frank Capra, the fascist, of meaning what it seems like he meant. I think he meant women should be cranking out babies, and I think that scene lands with a thud, as it should. But I still agree with you that in the context of the story and more broadly, I mean, the issue there is, like, is the character going to be happier in a world where community is built, or one where community is broken down by an extreme version of capitalism? And obviously, I think the point that the film is making is that, no, it's worse. It's generally worse for people. You know, she's not better off because she's, like, alienated and alone.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Okay. So once again, for those of you that are, like, still listening that don't know how the movie ends, of course, George returns to the bridge, says that famous line that we all love, "Clarence, I want to live again." He gets the Christmas carol, for the most sophisticated of you, perhaps the Adam Sandler movie Click ending, where everything, you wake up and everything is back to normal.
Yeah.
There's some cute stuff. This movie has a good sense of humor. There's a great part where of course, he's been punched in the face by a guy whose wife is the school teacher. He berates her for letting his daughter walk home without a coat on or whatever. And there's actually, I want to return to some of the shitty things that George Bailey does near the end of the movie before he has his epiphany, because I thought it was I liked it a lot. There's a great part where he's elatedly going, "My mouth's bleeding, Bert. My mouth's bleeding." He runs into some of the townspeople or somebody or whatever, and they goes like, "Oh, George, they're all looking for you," or whatever. And he goes, "Yeah, isn't it great? I'm going to jail." And of course, he gets there, and it very, very importantly, both thematically and whatever else, I'm sure, as we're going to discuss, while George has been away, his wife has basically called up everyone in town telling them that he's in trouble and that he needs to come up with a large sum of money very quickly. And all of the people that you've grown to get to know and learn to love over the course of the movie all come together and, basically no questions asked, are like, "Yeah, how much do you need?" And there's even a scene where the bank examiner puts a five in the or whatever, like puts a little bit of money in the pot and just rips up the which is cute. Interestingly, I'm sure for your point of view or whatever you're gonna say, he of course gets the telegram from his friend who early on had invested in plastics and now is also rich, maybe even richer than Potter. He gets a cable from him saying, "My office has been," and $25,000 at the time is so much money. "My office has been instructed to wire you up to $25,000. Hee haw and Merry Christmas." And of course, his brother, and this is again one of those things that tugs at the heartstring a little bit. His brother leaves his ceremony to get the medal to come home, and he toasts
to my big brother George, the richest man in town,
which is sweet. And then George gets the letter from Clarence that says, no man is a failure who has friends. We get the bell thing that everyone
got
knows.
His wings.
Just to put a pin in it. That's what we're talking about.
And I got to tell you, I was not moved by the stuff about the brother. Like, I guess my cynicism about the U.S. military has just gone so deep that, like,
sure, that's fine.
Those bits didn't move me, but I get what you mean.
My issue isn't that.
My issue is, so as a story, it all works. It works really well. It's really, really well done. Like, I endorsed people watching it before listening to this thing because, like, it is absolutely worthwhile to watch. It is a great story. And I think that the core values that come through underneath a lot of it are still good. You know, like we talked about the speech he gives, the ideas around community. Those are all things that, as long as you pull them in a certain way, those are values of the left. The problem for me is that this film stops short, stops way short of anything that could meaningfully even suggest how you would sustainably build this community that is being celebrated. Mm-hmm. Because the reality is, you know, what is being proposed is nothing. What is being proposed is like, hope that there's a guy like George Bailey in town who's willing to run a company at a loss and have a sort of shitty life, you know, that is extremely precarious, that can be undone by, you know, one uncle forgetfully losing $8,000, and the whole, you know, the whole, everything he's doing will fall, and then Potter the capitalist will win. You know, like, I joke about, like, why was Potter not hanged from Red Square in New Bedford?
Sure,
but
sure.
At some level, like, the film is so, it's so Bernie Sanders in the sense that it correctly shows you the problem and then totally misleads you about a solution. And look, I will contextualize, I get the context, you know, and again, this is a history lesson part two. Like, the film comes out in 1946.
Yes.
This is the exact moment at which American capitalism in particular is trying to figure out how to save the system from 30 years of complete devastation between the First World War, the crash of 29, the Great Depression, and the Second World War. Capitalism has just been through its worst convulsions in its history. And what is not said in the film, and I do hold it accountable for this, is that millions of people around the world are socialists. Millions of people around the world in that moment have said, capitalism has failed us. It has delivered nothing but failure over and over again. The Potters of the world took us into two wars and two depressions and poverty and slums and exploitation. And the United States is no different. It's maybe less so than somewhere like... well, certainly all of the Eastern Bloc, where people happily welcomed the Soviets pretty much as liberators from capitalism. You know, all of parts of Asia, which were having socialist revolutions, you know, Africa and Latin America, which were engaged in processes of socialist revolutions, but also Italy, Germany, France, and then to a lesser extent, but still, you know, Britain, Canada, and the US, where socialist parties are filling up with members. And in response to that, there is this construction of the welfare state, of a version of capitalism that will redistribute wealth from the Potters of the world back to the Baileys of the world, who can then redistribute wealth through the community in a range of ways, higher taxes, but also programs like welfare and unemployment insurance, and, you know, in most countries providing healthcare.
The subsidization of building and savings and loans.
Yes.
Importantly,
exactly.
I think.
Exactly.
Because there is a, that's kind of the, there is like a new dealism in this movie almost.
Yes.
Because 100%. There are some distinctions. One thing that I'm glad that you did not do, because it's wrong and it's an important distinction, is some people try to say, that what they'll say is they're like, well, there's nothing politically sophisticated or notable about this movie because George Bailey is just a small business owner. He is not.
Right.
Very, very importantly, he is the chairman of a building and loan, which is not a small business owner because a building and loan, the history of savings and loan, building and loan. The reason it's called a building and loan is because, it also builds the houses, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But, to get into the history of building and loans a little bit, this is going to be a super long episode, so I don't want to get too bogged down in any details or whatever, but basically you used to get a mortgage from an insurance company and, those loans were incredibly predatory. They always had these balloon payments at the end that were basically designed so that you would never pay your mortgage off. The savings and loan, or the building and loan, emerges as kind of an alternative to that, as a way for people to get way less onerous loans and actually be able to buy houses. another thing that's crucial about building and loan is a bit like a mutual fund, in that it's kind of like you put the money into the business, and then the business uses your money to both be able to run a profit, but also to grow the money that you've invested into it, so that you get higher interest rates, and you make money off of putting it into the business. It's also crucially, at least superficially, accountable to its members. At least, especially in this era, like, members have voting rights, and they have the ability to, again, at least theoretically, at least superficially, direct operations of the institution. Now, it's also implied, because of the people that are on the board, that how much money you put in plays a rather large role to how much influence you have. So it's not like it's this completely like, well, it's a consumer co-op or whatever, where everyone equally. I don't want to go that far, mm-hmm. right? Because it's mm-hmm. not. But it is like a distinctly different thing from just being able to say, and I've read this in places that always piss me off, like Potter is the bad banker and Bailey is the good banker.
Right.
That's not what's happening. Like, George Bailey does not own the building and loan in any meaningful sense. And the building and loan is not a thing that just, like, it takes your money and then you do whatever the fuck you want with it or anything mm-hmm. like that. Mm-hmm. There's more nuance to it than that.
Which would have been understood at the time better than it is now.
Better than it is now. And the other thing, too, is that during the New Deal, because they were so much better at getting people houses and getting people into mortgages and having them pay them off, and having people be able to own their own home, buildings and loans, savings and loans were heavily subsidized during the New Deal by FDR and yada 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 to make them even more friendly to the consumer, friendly to the homeowner, in whatever way you want to look at it. And that's important, because it's something that gets lost on modern audiences a little bit, but I just wanted to throw that out there.
It for sure gets misunderstood, and understandably, because, you know, that doesn't exist really anymore.
No, not at all.
Which, you know, I think in some ways is the point. Like, it failed.
Oh, it did. And, yeah, certainly.
You know, and now, you know, you can't, I'm not going to blame a 1946 film for not understanding mm-hmm. that by 2022 it had failed. Like, that's not fair.
Yeah.
Right.
Certainly.
But I also, I mean, looking back on the politics of the New Deal, it was always going to be a stopgap measure to mitigate the worst excesses of capitalism in order to protect and preserve the capitalist system as a whole, you know? And well, I am sympathetic to the message of, like, well, can't we have a better community that's more coherent and people are more together and everything else? By 1946, you'd had 30 years of abject misery created by capitalism, and you know, built on the, you know, 70 years before that as well, and slavery and colonialism, and, you know, the entire history of capitalism was so bad. And by 1946, there are so many people in the world who are ready to say enough. Enough is enough. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the reason, the you know, as I said, the thing that pushes the New Deal into existence is that it needs to find some kind of answer to the real challenge, which is socialism. The real challenge is coming from people who are saying, the system failed. It's insane. It's totally bankrupt. And mitigating and trying to manage and change a little bit here and there is not going to cut it. We need a different economic system that is actually based on those principles of community and care and dignity and respect for all people and so on. We need mm-hmm. to build an economic system that is responsive to that. And for that to be completely absent from the film, completely absent, not even a mention of it. No one even mm-hmm. accuses George Bailey of being a Red, which is in some ways the least believable aspect of the film, because, you know, why did Potter call him a socialist, right?
I have what I think is actually a very valid response to all of this. But out of all of the things that you said, that I will say is, I think, probably the best criticism I've heard so far that you've said is, why doesn't someone at some point call George Bailey a commie?
Yeah,
that is fair. That is in the Jackson fashion or whatever. That is the one weird trick. Mm-hmm. that you could use to make the movie more politically sophisticated.
And the thing about it for me, the reason that that it's noticeable to me is that because it is so notably absent, especially in that moment. I mean, in 1946, sure, the United States is actively intervening in Italian elections to make sure that the Italian left doesn't win the 1940 election, 48 elections. They're actively campaigning. Like they're going to war, about to go to war in Korea because of the communists in North Korea.
Absolutely.
Well, everything in 1945 switches to be about the Cold War and communism. So the idea that it's not mentioned, to me, it can't be an oversight. Can't be that Frank Capra, the guy who had Mussolini's picture on his desk, and Franco, guys whose whole ideology was about murdering trade unionists and communists, that he forgot about socialism? Mm-mm, I don't buy it.
Oh, no.
Certainly. That reflects back for me, right? I take that fact and then I play that back into the things about the film and I think, oh, yeah, okay, well, I liked a bunch of this stuff about community and the building and loan and, you know, the kind of the co-op mentality and all of these things. But I know now, for the lack of mentioning socialism, that it isn't an oversight, but a conscious decision to try to build a narrative where there is no need for socialism, where socialism isn't even on the agenda because capitalism isn't the problem. The problem is Potter. The problem is crony capitalism or Jewish bankers or whatever version of that you want to go with. And for me, that is a really profound weakness politically of the film. And it is of its moment. It's not just that kind of, well, retrospectively, the New Deal didn't work. It's actually, no, of its time, this is a director who chose to ignore what was a very common and popular reaction to the miseries of capitalism and instead redirect people to something that would be softer and would still serve the interests of American capitalism. That's my ultimate beef.
So I mostly disagree, but I don't. I will say, when it comes to Capra, Capra was a huge reactionary, and so was Jimmy Stewart.
Right, that's true. Yeah,
which is one of the things I think that makes me the most sad.
Yeah,
you know, of course, I don't do like celebrity worship or whatever, but there are some people where when you find out their politics are really bad, you get way more sad than others, and that's definitely one.
Yeah.
Despite being best friends with Henry Fonda, who was certainly not a reactionary.
No.
Very notably. And so I will say that I think this movie is great by accident, largely. Mm. The only thing that's not accidental about its greatness, basically the performances, and for that, I guess, aspect, I will give Capra credit. Like he was a good director. He got good performances out of his actors.
Definitely.
But I do largely think the movie is good in spite of Capra rather than because of it. And when we will end on the production notes, I think, because that's the most interesting stuff. I'll explain why that is. But I think that while the, you know, intention matters, and I won't disagree with you about, you know, it being intentional that the sort of actual active politics of the moment and the politics of what's happening are kind of placed very in the background or obfuscated or not mentioned at all or dulled or whatever you want to say about it, is I think you could argue it's intentional from a few different directions, because like a lot of people worked on writing this movie, and that's something I really want to talk about. But I will say that I think it is slightly more complex and more materialist in its outlook than maybe you're giving it credit for.
And why is that the case? Find out on the next episode of History Lesson Part 2. I wasn't actually trying to make a cliffhanger here. I just noticed that we were already at nearly the hour 40 mark, and there was still like at least another 45 minutes left for me to edit. And I'm morally opposed to releasing a podcast that is over 2 hours long. So the next one will be up in like hopefully 24 hours. I'm not trying to make you guys wait a super long time, and I certainly want both parts of this to be out before Christmas. But in the meantime, I guess I don't know. Happy holidays.